Morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning, occupiers. Occupy the commission, huh?
Yeah.
Saturday, April 13th, 2013, meeting of the Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission. Welcome, everyone. I guess you're not giving up too much being inside here this morning. Maybe there's some fishing to do out there. I don't know. But we're happy to see you. We're looking forward to your comments. So, and that's what we open this meeting with on Saturday mornings, open public input. We have a number of people who've signed up to speak with us. The rules are that the commission gives each citizen 3 minutes to present your comments. When you hear the beeping noise, that means your time is up, and we'd like you to conclude your remarks. You can finish your sentence and rapidly wrap up. If you don't hear or if you continue on, I will interrupt you politely. I will call up the first person, Chris DeLeon. And I'd like you to sit in front of one of the mics, and you can be about 5-6 inches from the mic.
You guys hear me?
Yes.
I've got a loud voice, so I can make it. I think I can make it work without the microphone. So, I am part of Occupy Skagit. I'm very proud to be part of that organization, and just trying to get the message out to, you know, what our thoughts are on the Skagit River. I grew up in Linwood, Washington. I've been fishing the Skycomish, the Stilly, and the Skagit since I was, I don't know, 6 years old when I tag along with my dad. So the fishery is very important to me. I have 2 daughters, a 9-year-old that's getting into fishing. I'll take her out in the lakes this year. And, you know, it's kind of a family thing for us. So this is really important for, you know, my family and a lot of other people that I know to really, you know, move forward and have that opportunity again when, you know, when things all work out. We had the Occupy Skagit event last week, and we had over 85 people show up, anglers that came out and fished. And just met and talked a little bit about, you know, what we're trying to do. We had a few folks that were up in the community that came out just to see what it was about, and that was very important to us because it does impact the communities up there, you know, as far as revenue and you know, what they believe their fisheries are about. A gentleman, Kevin Alseth, from the IGA in Darrington, got over 254 signatures in 4 days just for this event. So it's important up in those areas. I talked to a hotel up there, the two ladies that run Grace Haven Resorts, and when they used to have the Skagit open, that those little huts there that they have kitchens and everything like that, they'd be full. And we had some people come up for the event, and they asked if she had any room available. She goes, "I have all 5 of these things open." So it's very important for the resource. It's very important for the communities up there, and I think it's very important for the angling community. You know, we have over 94 people that sent emails supporting this. You know, we'd love to have a whole bunch of guys come in here and flood you guys with Occupy Skagit shirts and everything, but that's not what it's about. It's about trying to be proactive and putting a plan together to see where we can go with this. I wasn't going to take my whole 3 minutes, but I just wanted the folks in the commission to understand that, you know, we do have a large conglomerate of people that are watching this and want to see where it goes. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, the next 3 people want to come up together. So I'll call them up to the front table. They will each have 3 minutes, and that's Wayne Klein, Steve Franson, and Kurt Kramer. So you'll each have 3 minutes, but you're a united front, I can tell. Okay, would you also just repeat your name for the record?
I will.
Yeah.
Well,
okay. Mr.
Good morning. I'm Wayne Klein from Mount Vernon. In 1990, I was in a position that allowed me to move anywhere in the U.S. I chose Washington and specifically Skagit County. At the risk of offending the locals, it wasn't for the tulips either. I moved my family 2,800 miles for the world-class steelhead fishing available on the Skagit River. Well, last weekend, a group of us gathered on the Skagit in what was billed as Occupy Skagit, a trendy name for an expression of frustration over a situation that we as laymen see as heavy-handed treatment by NMFS. I'm here today to try and speak for that group. We're aware that WDFW currently doesn't get to call all the shots when it comes to steelhead management. However, WDFW does regulate our fishing, and as our only local wildlife authority, you are also our only regulatory advocates for recreational angling opportunities. The Occupy Skagit participants are not opposed to steelhead conservation. In fact, we're very much in favor of it. It is our belief that conservation is not only compatible with catch and release fishing, but the two go hand in hand as responsible stewardship and management of a finite resource. In our research, we've been unable to find a river on the North American continent that averages a run of 7,800 fish that closes to fishing so prematurely, except for the Skagit. Recently, I did a tour of local businesses impacted by the closed season. Their estimated losses range from 10 to 20%. For some, this equates to a year's income for every 5 years the river is closed. This year is the fifth in the last decade, and there's no policy in place to end it. Under current ESA listing, all of Puget Sound steelhead are defined and regulated as a single distinct population segment. In aggregate, they are indeed doing poorly and protection is warranted. And although the Skagit Basin is included in this listing, available evidence would indicate that conditions are improving, but there's no mechanism in place to restore fishing. In my recent discussions with Scott Schuyler, the Natural Resources Director of the Upper Skagit Tribe, I've discovered that we both seek the same resolution, basin-specific allowable impacts. It was expressed to me that the tribe supports our efforts with the caveat that WDFW support them in seeking these allowable impacts and help with their ongoing steelhead population studies. My two friends here with decades of fish management experience will provide a nuts and bolts snapshot of what we believe to be the remedy.
Thank you. Mr. Franson.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Commissioners, and Director Anderson. I'm Steve Franson from Olympia. I've fished the Skagit River since 1972, and I lived on the river for 15 years when I first learned about Occupy Skagit. About Wayne was just making crazy talk. But as I examine the interests of Occupy Skagit, I've concluded that the catch and release season is not inconsistent with steelhead survival and recovery. NIMS Steelhead Status Review observed that the elimination of direct harvest of wild steelhead in the mid-1990s largely addressed any problems of fishing mortality. In its 2007 ESA listing, NIMS also said, "We'll work with all stakeholders to help ensure that recovery planning proceeds apace so that Puget Sound steelhead continue to provide the spectrum of ecological, cultural, and economic benefits that underscore their status as the state fish of Washington. We want to be sure and provide that chance to work with us." The way you recover a depressed anadromous fish run is to reduce or eliminate the limiting factor. If harvest is not a limiting factor, then how does closing the rivers help the populations recover? Well, it doesn't, and it hasn't. Wild Skagit steelhead are the most abundant stock in Puget Sound. Since 1978, the run size has averaged 7,822 steelhead, ranging from around 2,600 to 16,000. The spawning escapement has averaged 6,857 steelhead after harvest, both incidental and directed. As far as anyone can know for certain, this variation in population size is completely normal. There are good years and bad years. Freshwater floods and droughts limit the outmigrating smolt population from year to year. The freshwater habitat has not really changed much in the last 30 years. Some parts have degraded further, and some parts have improved. On balance, it would be hard to quantify any significant change. Marine survival factors limit the percent of smolts that survive to adulthood and return from the ocean each year. The proximate cause limiting wild Limiting Adult Wild Steelhead Stock Abundance is Marine Survival. Occupy Skagit is an evidence-based approach to steelhead management. Recent studies on the Vetter in British Columbia and on the Skagit show that the incidental catch-and-release hooking mortality is less than half the 10% value presently assigned. The current ESA allowable impacts in the 6 Puget Sound Basin aggregate of 4.2% is an arbitrary acceptance of what already existed and found not harmful, rather than an analysis of what is possible and equally not harmful. I'll lose my place. Skagit steelhead productivity shows that the catch and release seasons from 1981 through 2009 have no measurable effect on population size, even the combination of catch and release incidental mortality and the limited direct harvest indicate that fishing mortality has had no measurable effect on wild steelhead population abundance over the past 30 years. Occupy Skagit is pointing out that regulations could permit catch-and-release steelhead seasons to be implemented with no measurable risk to future population abundance, and anglers and the community can obtain the social and economic benefits associated with the added fishing activity. These benefits can be enjoyed while simultaneously conserving wild Skagit steelhead for as long as steelhead habitat is also conserved. It's just about that simple. We need your support, and I thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kramer.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Commissioners, Director Anderson. I'm Kurt Kramer. I live in Marysville, Washington, and for more decades than I care to admit, I've spent, enjoyed the North Puget Sound rivers as both as an avid angler and a professional biologist, and I consider the Skagit River my home water, and I've spent innumerable days and hours in enjoying that resource. I'm here to talk about that a little bit. I understand perfectly why there's currently no fishing that targets wild steelhead in the Skagit River. That's understandable. It's an ESA fish, and rules need to be adjusted. The issue, however, is there's no provisions to fish if and when that population rebounds. If there were 10,000 fish a year for the next 5 years with a scheme goal of 6,000 fish, there's no provision to provide recreational opportunities at those fish. And that's what this is about. When one looks across the coast landscape and ESA management within the western half of the United States on anadromous fish, you see a variety of approaches and a number of issues in fisheries management with these ESA listed stocks. One of the best approaches that I've seen is when recovery plans and fisheries management plans and determination of fishing impact plans look at the individual productivity of the stocks that are be considered as part of the ESA listing stocks. A perfect example of what we're talking about is what we see with Puget Sound Chinook. There, the co-managers developed a harvest management plan, a five-year plan they went to NOAA Fisheries with that allows for a pretty wide diversity of allowable impacts, RERs, or recovery expectation rates. They range from a low of 7% to more than 50% depending on the stock. This seems to me to be a very reasoned and thought-out approach, and of all the various plans I looked at, may be as good as any that I've seen. In 2010, the agency, my understanding, and its co-managers submitted a draft steelhead harvest management plan to the National Marine Fisheries Service for review, and it's exactly this kind of basin-by-basin approach that the agency and its co-managers submitted to the federal governments. I support that, understand that, and encourage that program to continue forward. I think it needs to be done in a proactive manner so that when the fish recovers, and we all believe that it will, as Steve mentioned, we believe a big limiting factor is marine survival. So there's going to be more and more indications that marine survival across the Pacific is changing and improving. Chinook stocks are going down in Alaska. They're coming up here. It's not unreasonable to expect to see the same thing happen with steelhead in Puget Sound. One of the most gratifying pieces of news I've heard in the last 5 years is last year in the fish returning Puget Sound, the percentage of the previous year's population returned as repeat spawners was roughly twice what it has been for the last 15 years, and was very dissimilar to the average that we saw in the 70s and 80s. And one of the things I've noticed is in this period of bad time, the older fish in the population have declined dramatically. The marine survival is affecting all out through the ocean. The Skagit has three ESA-listed stocks, the Chinooks, the Steelhead, and the Bull Trout. We allow targeted fisheries on the wild Chinooks, the wild Bull Trout. We do not allow them on Steelhead, regardless of what the population size. The Bull Trout are thriving, and we think the same sort of biological approach with sound management and consideration of resources is very appropriate. I'd like to thank you generously for your time, and hopefully we can answer some of your questions and discuss these in more details of whatever your interest may be. Thanks.
I know there's a lot of interest. There's going to be a lot of comments and questions coming at you, but can you first explain why repeat spawners have gone up? Do you have a theory about that?
The theory, in the 70s and 80s, we would see, of the fish returning, we typically would see 8 to 25% of the fish that spawned the previous year would survive to spawn, and the average is around 13 to 14%. But what was seen in the last decade or 15 years is that percentage has fallen to roughly half of that. And the same thing happened with the percentage of the first-time fish returning. The number of fish that returned as three-salt fish versus two-salt fish declined dramatically. What that indicates to me is that when the fish are dying in the ocean, that mortality is continuing the whole time they're out in the ocean. The longer they're in the ocean, the higher the mortality. If we were just whacking the smolts that first month, those kinds of ratios would not change. And so when we're seeing, you know, that's it's more than a Puget Sound issue. It's an ocean-wide issue, and that's why things like Alaska are so important, is it shows that it's changing. When I saw the repeat spawners, which would be the first, hopefully, single that we receive that the populations are turning around, and if we can do our homework now and get in position so that when the fish are here, we'll be in position to go fishing.
Thank you. Director Anderson?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Good morning. Thanks for being here. I just had a few questions to help me make sure I understand what your perspective is and what you're asking for. If you look at the last 5 or 6 years when we've had run sizes that have been below the goal of 6,000, with the exception of this last year, I think it was 6,125 or so. And we have the forecast for this year is something over 4,000, so still not in very good shape. Are you advocating that under those conditions that during the time frame when we have the wild fish returning, basically from the middle of February through the middle of May, are you advocating that under those conditions that catch and release be allowed? Is the request that you're advocating for is more of a let's put ourselves in the position that we can manage on a basin by basin approach, so that, and this may well be the system that comes back first, that when we're in that position and we have run sizes that are, and we have some, at least some number of run sizes that get us above 6,000, that under those circumstances, that the first thing that we would do is look for catch and release opportunities being provided in the Skagit.
Can I take this?
Well, what we're asking for, first of all, is basin-specific allowable impacts. And under the what we're trying to do is be proactive. We don't want to be here, coming in here several years from now saying, okay, we've had several years of above this floor escapement level, but we're not getting any seasons because there's not a mechanism in place to open it back up. So we do think that the Skagit is going to be the first one to recover, and we don't think the other rivers should be attached to it to hold it back, to hold back our opportunity to go fishing on the Skagit. If the Nooksack is not making escapement, that's bad for the Nooksack, and I feel sorry for those guys, but if the Skagit is making escapement, I think we should have a season. And also the forecast is, as Curtis pointed out to us, as the runs improve, the forecast is always going to lag behind what the actual numbers are. So we think that in next year, we'll be over to the escapement, the floor escapement, which is kind of an arbitrary number anyway that was just settled on, not ever with a real scientific basis, but we'll accept that number. We'll take that number. That's what we used to use before, and we'll use it again. But before any of this can happen, we need to have this basin-specific allowable impacts by the feds approved. Otherwise, it's not going to happen. We're going to be waiting for all the rivers to recover before anybody gets to fish anywhere. And that's we just want to be proactive. We want to have the regulation changed so that when we start seeing these numbers above the escapement level, we can throw the switch and go fishing. Right now, there's no switch to be thrown.
So just a little bit of conversation
sure.
here, if that's okay. So,
that's what this is for.
So the first part of my question, which had to do with at run sizes like we've seen in the last 4 or 5 years with, let's just say, holding out the one that was above 6,000. But when, you know, when we're down in the 2,500, 3,900, 5,400, then I'm not hearing you advocate for an allowance of a catch-and-release fishery under those conditions. Do I have that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And so...
Yeah, let's
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Even if a fishery could occur at low population abundance, we're not going to advocate for that. It helps to understand that the 6,000 interim escapement level is an easy 50% above the calculated MSY-MSH escapement goal that one might choose. So we've got a 50% buffer. And one part of me says, well, gee, why don't we fish on lower run sizes? Well, because we also know that forecasting precision ranges from fair to poor. So we might forecast a run of 6,000 and schedule a fishing season, but the actual run size may only be 4,000, maybe less. And so that buffer for the time being is probably a good thing. I think what, if I can sort of summarize our advocacy is, I think it's more important to develop a plan and that the details of the plan are things that ought to be the product of a dialogue and negotiation with NIMS. Of, you know, let's get at what, get at the specific river basin and then what are the best reasonable and safe choices for allowable impacts. You know, they might want or we might want to stair-step them incrementally according to population abundance. Those would be details that I think it's premature to, you know, get down in the weeds and try and figure that out. The commitment to developing the plan and working with and negotiating a plan that meets the SA requirements is if we can, we've got to get over that first hurdle, and then the details can come later.
We can make some guesses on based on our experience what those details may look like.
Sure.
That's really for the dialogue between the co-managers and the national, and the federal government to work out. And you know what we're suggesting is that it's something very similar to what you're very familiar with in the Chinook and those kinds of places.
So, if I just one last, maybe Kurt, you talked about the structure of the steelhead management plan that we've submitted to NIMS. I think it was in 2010 that we haven't heard much from in response. It's that kind of a structure with some additional detail added to it, perhaps, that ensures that we have an approach on a system-by-system basis, but in probably focusing on Skagit first, maybe. Is that... Did I understand you that?
That's correct. I mean, you know, to the extent that I'm familiar with it, what was submitted is those are exactly the kind of approaches that we looked at. There's you know, specific guesstimates of what the allowable impacts would be on the Skagit River. I think it's on the Snohomish Basin. There was actually some talk about a tier-stepped allowable impacts depending on relative abundance. You'd be it might be at 5% on one low abundance. At half again as many fish, it might be 10%. And you had twice as many fish, it might be at 15%. Those are the concepts that I think needs to be captured in those sorts of plans. How exactly those concepts are to be captured is you know, in your staffs and the co-manager staffs and NIMS staff to develop. there's lots of things going on in Skagit to lead us to believe that's going to be the first in the basin to recover there. And it's also, it has a long history of supporting catch and release fisheries. It has a big culture. For many years, for avid steelheaded fishermen in the world, the Skagit River in its catch and release season was on their bucket list. I mean, it was up there with going to the Skeena system in Canada. I mean, it was a significant state resource.
Yeah, you don't have to persuade us about the the value of the fishery. We get that. You made a comment that I thought got to the heart of one of the hardest issues. And that is, you said, the Nooksack, you know, maybe those guys will have to wait longer. Well, the fact is, people move to where the fishing opportunity is. So your thoughts on displaced effort and how intense the effort would be if we opened up one river system?
Yeah. We would take further restriction on that. Maybe it's only open 3 days a week.
You don't mind a combat fishery?
It's a big system. It's a big system. Yes, we do mind a combat fishery, but it's better than no fishery.
Okay, well, all of this has to be discussed.
I mean, those are going to be really fun discussions to have down the road when we're positioned to actually have
this.
Can't
settle it here.
Yeah. But the Skagit Basin, and the Sauk River, you're looking at 40 miles of river that you put people on. It's a pretty big water. You can put a lot of diverse users on there. The truth of the matter is that the displaced interest on the Skagit and the Sauk and the other S rivers in the South are now going elsewhere in the state to fish.
Yeah.
And to some extent, you're maybe providing a relief valve for some of your concerns.
I did think about that because I have a place up in Forks. And sorry, we can't have you come back up here, but what we're doing is identifying issues for later conversation, so you'll have your shot again, I'm sure. Commissioner Carpenter?
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I just wanted to say this is more of a comment than a question, that I'm really pleased with the way you fellows prepared your presentation. I think it's the way we should do business. Educate us and share with us your values about things. I was born in Mount Vernon, and I grew up on the Dyke Road right above the Forks. So I know a little bit about fishing that system. I know how big it is. I know where there's opportunity on the beach in a variety of places. And throughout a very, very lengthy, wide-bodied river. More anecdotal than anything, Mount Vernon is a rural community. If you're on I-5 and you're going the speed limit, you're through it in about 15 seconds, 20 seconds if there's a traffic jam on I-5. And if you go east from there, and Mount Vernon's the biggest city in the county. And then from east of there, you got Cedar Woolley, Lyman, Hamilton, Concrete, Marblemount, and some other little burgs where there needs to be some economic relief. And if we can craft a meaningful opportunity that's conservation based, I think that's what we should consider doing. I remember growing up in Mount Vernon, and we'd have to go to the restaurant at truck stop at the truck stop in South Mount Vernon at 2:30 in the morning with my dad and my uncle and my brother to get breakfast in order to get to the river to launch, to be there before there was nowhere to park. And those are fond memories. Lines to launch your boat, you had lines. Then you had to find a place to park. I don't expect that I'll ever get back to that again, but in my view, conservation is our primary responsibility, and behind that, closely followed by opportunity. So that I think this opportunity that you guys have presented is very meaningful, and from my perspective, it's appreciated.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Kurt.
I just say that, I think I have a long history and some credibility in being conservation-based.
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
If this was a serious conservation issue, I probably would not be here. Mm-hmm. And one other comment about the effort. The lack of mutual access steelhead also impacts lack to be able to fish other species in the river. And the Skagit River has one of the few state blue ribbon trout fisheries in terms of sea run, cutthroat, and bull trout. If the Skagit catch and release fishing was open today, I would not be fishing steelhead. I'd be up fishing bull trout, fly fishing bull trout, and enjoying a catch and release fishery that probably would exceed anything I've experienced on the Yakima River. And because of what's going on steelhead, we've lost that opportunity as well. So there's more than just the steelhead that's at stake.
Okay. Commissioner Jennings?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to compliment you guys also on laying out the issues in a very understandable way, coming to us with the conservation focus as well. And this is important for me, recognizing that it's going to be a multi-year process before we get there. Because one of the things you are dealing with is state agency, federal agency, a lot of stakeholder groups. So it's not a wave your magic wand and have the conversation happen. It really will take a little bit of time. But I think, you know, the point you're raising, you know, resonate very strongly with me. Thank you.
One of the things about the time is we recognize that the agency is severely strapped for resources. And it's been my experience that when you have issues like this, you're almost always better off working in a proactive fashion than trying to put fires out or a critical method. If we can't do anything for a couple of years, we're better off using our resources in an orderly and thought-out process than going backwards. And I think that's important. You know, we're probably on the cusp of marine survival changes, and we may see more steel. We won't know what that cusp really was. You know, in 2020, we can be able to look back and say, yeah, it happened in 2012 or 2015. But you know, we're on the cusp, and we want to prepare for that.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've got some more people who've signed up. Okay. No, we just have one more. Ken Miller? Shifting subjects.
Madam Chair and Commission members, I'm Ken Miller, small forest landowner. Been here for about 6 years whining about the fine print and the bear damage depredation permits, and I'm pleased to come and report to the we met yesterday with the WDFW and got everything worked out. Not 100%, but we're so close it doesn't matter. And I want to thank the commission for whatever influence they had, the director, and I think it's Deputy Director Mike Sensi, and particularly Sean Carroll, who is the one that we work with. So that was the primary reason. While I was here, I stepped into the meeting and listened for a little bit, and I heard the presentation that you folks heard about the forest habitat protection stuff, and I just can't resist coming in and adding a little perspective in what little time I have. And I really appreciated some of the questions that came from the commissioners during that presentation. I've worked with David Whipple and Terry Jackson for about 10 years. I've been involved in all of the processes around forests and fish. They made a very good presentation. They do represent WDFW very well in the forest and fish negotiations. I consider both of them friends. So, but I do want to add a little perspective to what it is. They talked about the forest and fish habitat conservation plan that we're working with to meet the federal rules. This is the Idaho rule. This is the Oregon rule that I'm required to follow. This is the Washington rule that I'm supposed to follow and understand, and they've added to this. This was the 1999 version, I think. There are a lot of good, bad, and ugly stuff in there, and David commented about their, you know, trying to move towards incentives. There aren't many incentives in here. There are more disincentives in here. We look at site-specific ways to do things, but we are losing perspective, I think, in the way we're going. Probably nothing we can do about it. Commissioner Jennings asked about fractionalization. This does not help me get my kids or grandkids interested in keeping my farm forested. It is worth a hell of a lot more for development. It was well written for small landowners in that on paper, in the rule, there are accommodations that were made. And by the way, the forest and fish passage program they talked about, it's just excellent. And that's really, that it really is helping the habitat, opened up a lot of miles, a really good program. But in here, after 10 years of fighting and whining, like I've been up here, you know, there's a forest repair and easement program that's just totally unfunded that was supposed to compensate smalls for. There are alternate harvest prescriptions that were supposed to be available for smalls for smaller harvests and for lower impact harvests. Can't even get a conversation going on that. We were promised technical support so we could understand some of this stuff, so we could have somebody come out and show us where does the fish part of the stream end and the non-fish end, and hell, they're still arguing, and yeah, that's what David and Terry are spending most of their time about, all this nuances that go way over the small landowners' head. And finally, I just can't resist, after hearing the folks in the background pointing out that these rules are primarily required so that I subsidize the fishermen by leaving a part, a significant part of my 50-year investment, so that it will protect fish habitat so they can come up and kill them, although I hear the catch and release is good. And I don't mean to throw rocks at the fishermen. I own timberland because I like the streams and fish and critters and that stuff. But the big picture is we got a long ways to go if we're going to encourage more folks to keep lands forested and do things that help critters rather than, I know there's a lot of things going on that prevent us from getting the habitat that we want, spotted owl, whatever, that marble murrelet. There's a lot of folks out there that intentionally manage so they don't get that kind of habitat because they'll be punished if they do. Right. And that's just a screwed up system.
Don't leave the front table yet. That was a great presentation.
Thank you. I didn't mean to start another fight.
No. I mean, we're all very aware, but very effective in comparing the size of the rule package between states. I hear you. We have a small forest land ownership, too. My husband worked for the Fish and Wildlife Service, so his whole life has been, his career was about protection of biological diversity, and he bristles at the rules that this small timber forest owner has to live with. Yeah. It challenges his technical skills to fill out the Forest Practice Act applications. So I hear you. I think that many of us do. Some of the rules, they're well-intentioned, but if they're not being enforced, why do we have them? If they're not being funded, why do we have them? The incentives are meaningless unless they're implemented. So, very effective.
And I should have pointed out, even though I'm bitching about it, this agreement that was signed between the state and the federal services was signed on my little tree farm just south of here.
So you're part of the history of this thing.
Maybe I'm part of the problem.
Yeah. Any other comments? Commissioner Jennings?
I just wanted to say thank you for where you started the conversation, which was coming back to us with feedback, positive feedback, which is appreciated about the overall process dealing with the fair deposition. Right. Issue. So
it's a tough issue.
It's so seldom that when things go well, we receive positive feedback about the process. That's what I'm saying. Thank you for coming back and your time to give us that. And your points are well made on the Small Forest Practices Handbook. My comment is we probably use a much larger font.
Commissioner Mencken?
Well, David said it all. I always like to see Ken because he's always polite and he's complimentary and he comes with good information. So we enjoy seeing and hearing from you. Thank you very much.
If you ever want to know more about forest practices and smalls, I'll be happy to come back and bore the hell out of you.
I think you've educated us fine.
And I think the fishermen do owe you some thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, that concludes the open public input item on the morning agenda.